Chapter 7, Conversation with Madmen. As for Alverdon, he was concerned only with making holiday. His ship, the Ophiuchus, was not to be expected for at least a month. Therefore, he had a month to spend as lavishly as he might wish. So it was that on the sixth day after his arrival at Everest, Bell Alverdon left his host and took passage on a terrestrial air transport company's largest jet, Stratospheric, traveling between Everest and the terrestrial capital, Washen. If he took a commercial liner rather than the speedy cruiser placed at his service by Ennius, it was done deliberately, out of the reasonable curiosity of a stranger and an archaeologist, toward the ordinary life of men inhabiting such a planet as Earth. And for another reason, too. Alverdon was from the Sirian sector, notoriously the sector above all others in the galaxy where anti-terrestrian prejudice was strong. Yet he had always liked to think he had not succumbed to that prejudice himself. As a scientist, as an archaeologist, he couldn't afford to. Of course, he had grown into the habit of thinking of Earthmen in certain set caricature types, and even now the word Earthman seemed an ugly one to him. But he wasn't really prejudiced. At least, he didn't think so. For instance, if an Earthman had ever wished to join an expedition of his or work for him in any capacity, and had the training and the ability, he would be accepted, if there were an opening for him, that was. And if the other members of the expedition didn't mind too much, that was the rub. Usually the fellow workers objected, and then what could you do? He pondered the matter. Now, certainly he would have no objection to eating with an Earthman or even bunking with one in case of need, assuming the Earthmen were reasonably clean and healthy. In fact, he would in all ways treat him as he would treat anyone else, he thought. Yet there was no denying that he would always be conscious of the fact that an Earthman was an Earthman. He couldn't help that. That was the result of a childhood immersed in an atmosphere of bigotry so complete that it was almost invisible, so entire that you accepted its axioms as second nature. Then you left it and saw it for what it was when you looked back. But here was his chance to test himself. He was in a plane with only Earthmen about him, and he felt perfectly natural, almost. Well, just a little self-conscious. Alverdon looked about at the undistinguished and normal faces of his fellow passengers. They were supposed to be different, these Earthmen, but could he have told these from ordinary men if he had met them casually in a crowd? He didn't think so. The women weren't bad-looking. His brows knit. Of course, even tolerance must draw the line somewhere. Intermarriage, for instance, was quite unthinkable. The plane itself was, in his eyes, a small affair of imperfect construction. It was, of course, atomic-powered, but the application of the principle was far from efficient. For one thing, the power unit was not well shielded. Then it occurred to Alverdon that the presence of stray gamma rays and a high neutron density in the atmosphere might well strike Earthmen as less important than it might strike others. Then the view caught his eyes. From the dark wine purple of the extreme stratosphere, Earth presented a fabulous appearance. Beneath him, the vast and misted land areas in sight, obscured here and there by the patches of sun-bright clouds, showed a desert orange. Behind them, slowly receding from the fleeing stratoliner, was the soft and fuzzy nightline, within whose dark shadow there was the sparking of the radioactive areas. His attention was drawn from the window by the laughter among the others. It seemed to center about an elderly couple, comfortably stout, and all smiles. Alverdon nudged his neighbor. "What's going on?" His neighbor paused to say, "They've been married 40 years, and they're making the grand tour." "The grand tour?" "You know, all around the earth." The elderly man, flushed with pleasure, was recounting in voluble fashion his experiences and impressions, His wife joined in periodically with meticulous corrections involving completely unimportant points, these being given and taken in the best of humor. To all this, the audience listened with the greatest attention, so that to Arvidun it seemed that Earthmen were as warm and human as any people in the galaxy. And then someone asked, "And when is it that you're scheduled for the 60? "In about a month," came the ready, cheerful answer, "16th November." "Well," said the questioner, "I hope you have a nice day for it. My father reached his 60 in a damned pouring rain. I've never seen one like it since. I was going with him, you know, a fellow likes company on a day like that, and he complained about the rain every step of the way. We had an open bi-wheel, you see, and we got soaked." "Listen," I said, "what are you complaining about, Dad? I've got to come back." There was a general howl of laughter, which the anniversary couple were not backward in joining. Arvidun, however, felt plunged in horror as a distinct and uncomfortable suspicion entered his mind. He said to the man sharing his seat, "This 60, this subject of conversation here, I take it they're referring to euthanasia. I mean, you're put out of the way when you reach your 60th birthday, aren't you?" Arvidun's voice faded somewhat as his neighbor choked off the last of his chuckles to turn in his seat and favor the questioner with a long and suspicious stare. Finally, he said, "Well, what do you think he meant?" Arvidun made an indefinite gesture with his hand and smiled rather foolishly. He had known of the custom, but only academically, something in a book, something discussed in a scientific paper. But it was now borne in upon him that it actually applied to living beings, that the men and women surrounding him could, by custom, live only to 60. The man next to him was still staring. "Hey, fella, where are you from? Don't they know about the 60 in your hometown?" "We call it the time," said Arvidun feebly. "I'm from back there." He jerked his thumb hard over his shoulder, and after an additional quarter minute, the other withdrew that hard, questioning stare. Arvidun's lips quirked. These people were suspicious. That facet of the caricature, at least, was authentic. The elderly man was talking again. "She's coming with me," he said, nodding toward his genial wife. "She's not due for about 3 months after that, but there's no point in her waiting, she thinks, and we might as well go together. Isn't that it, Chubby?" "Oh, yes," she said, and giggled rosily. "Our children are all married and have homes of their own. I'd just be a bother to them. Besides, I couldn't enjoy the time anyway without the old fellow. So we'll just leave off together." Whereupon the entire list of passengers seemed to engage themselves in a simultaneous arithmetical calculation of the time remaining to each, a process involving conversion factors from months to days that occasioned several disputes among the married couples involved. One small fellow with tight clothes and a determined expression said fiercely, "I've got exactly 12 years, 3 months, and 4 days left. 12 years, 3 months, and 4 days. Not a day more, not a day less," which someone qualified by saying reasonably, "Unless you die first, of course." "Nonsense," was the immediate reply. "I have no intention of dying first. Do I look like the sort of man who would die first? I'm living 12 years, 3 months, and 4 days, and there's not a man here with the hardihood to deny it." And he looked very fierce indeed. A slim young man took a long, dandyish cigarette from between his lips to say darkly, "It's well for them that can calculate it out to a day. There's many a man living past his time." "Ah, surely," said another, and there was a general nod and a rather inchoate air of indignation arose. "Not," continued the young man, interspersing his cigarette puffs with a complicated flourish intended to remove the ash, "that I see any objection to a man, or woman, wishing to continue on past their birthday to the next council day, particularly if they have some business to clean up. It's these sneaks and parasites that try to go past to the next census, eating the food of the next generation. He seemed to have a personal grievance there. Avedon interposed gently, "But aren't the ages of everyone registered? They can't very well pass their birthday too far, can they?" A general silence followed, admixtured not a little with contempt at the foolish idealism expressed. Someone said at last, in diplomatic fashion, as though attempting to conclude the subject, "Well, there isn't much point living past the 60, I suppose." "Not if you're a farmer," shot back another vigorously. "After you've been working in the field for half a century, you'd be crazy not to be glad to call it off. How about the administrators, though, and the businessmen?" Finally, the elderly man, whose 40th wedding anniversary had begun the conversation, ventured his own opinion, emboldened perhaps by the fact that, as a current victim of the 60, he had nothing to lose. "As to that," he said, "it depends on who you know." And he winked with a sly innuendo. "I knew a man once who was 60 the year after the 810 census and lived till the 820 census caught him. He was 69 before he left off. 69! Think of that." "How did he manage that?" "He had a little money, and his brother was one of the Society of Ancients. There's nothing you can't do if you've got that combination." There was general approval of that sentiment. "Listen," said the young man with the cigarette emphatically, "I had an uncle who lived a year past, just a year. He was just one of these selfish guys who don't feel like going, you know? A lot he cared for the rest of us. And I didn't know about it, you see, or I would have reported him, believe me, because a guy should go when it's his time. It's only fair to the next generation. Anyway, he got caught all right. And the first thing I knew, the Brotherhood calls on me and my brother and wants to know how come we didn't report him. I said, hell, I didn't know anything about it. Nobody in my family knew anything about it. I said, we hadn't seen him in 10 years. My old man backed us up. But we got fined 500 credits just the same. That's when you don't have any pull." The look of discomposure on Arverdon's face was growing. Were these people madmen to accept death so? To resent their friends and relatives who tried to escape death? Could he, by accident, be on a ship carrying a cargo of lunatics to asylum or euthanasia? Or were these simply earthmen? His neighbor was scowling at him again, and his voice broke in on Arverdon's thoughts. "Hey, fella, where's back there?"
"Pardon me?"
"I said, where are you from? You said, back there. What's back there, hey?" Arverdon found the eyes of all upon him now, each with its own sudden spark of suspicion in it. Did they think him a member of this Society of Ancients of theirs? Had his questioning seen the cajolery of an agent provocateur? So he met that by saying, in a burst of frankness, "I'm not from anywhere on Earth. I'm Bell Arverdon from Baron, Sirius Sector. What's your name?" And he held out his hand. He might as well have dropped an atomic explosive capsule into the middle of the plane. The first silent horror on every face turned rapidly into angry, bitter hostility that flamed at him. The man who had shared his seat rose stiffly and crowded into another, where the pair of occupants squeezed closely together to make room for him. Faces turned away. Shoulders surrounded him, hemmed him in. For a moment, Arverdon burned with indignation. Earthmen to treat him so. Earthmen! He had held out the hand of friendship to them. He, a Syrian, had condescended to treat with them, and they had rebuffed him. And then, with an effort, he relaxed. It was obvious that bigotry was never a one-way operation, that hatred bred hatred.
He was conscious of a presence beside him, and he turned toward it resentfully. Yes, it was the young man with the cigarette. He was lighting a new one as he spoke. "Hello," he said. "My name's Crean. Don't let those jerks get you." "No one's getting me," said Arverden shortly. He was not too pleased with the company, nor was he in the mood for patronizing advice from an Earthman. But Crean was not trained to the detection of the more delicate nuances. He puffed his cigarette to life in man-sized drags and tapped its ashes over the arm of the seat into the middle aisle. "Provincials," he whispered with contempt. "Just a bunch of farmers. They lack the galactic view. Don't bother with them. Now you take me. I got a different philosophy. Live and let live, I say. I got nothing against outsiders. If they want to be friendly with me, I'll be friendly with them. What the hell? They can't help being an outsider, just like I can't help being an Earthman. Don't you think I'm right?" And he tapped Arverden familiarly on the wrist. Arverden nodded and felt a crawling sensation at the other's touch. Social contact with a man who felt resentful over losing a chance to bring about his uncle's death was not pleasant, quite regardless of planetary origin. Crean leaned back. "Heading for Shika?" "What did you say your name was? Arverden?" "Arverden. Yes, I'm going to Shika. That's my hometown. Best damn city on Earth. Going to stay there long?" "Maybe. I haven't made any plans." "Say, I hope you don't object to my saying that I've been noticing your shirt. Mind if I take a close look?" "Made in Sirius, huh?" "Yes, it is." "It's very good material. Can't get anything like that on Earth." "Say, bud, you wouldn't have a spare shirt like that in your luggage, would you? I'd pay for it if you wanted to sell it. It's a snappy number." Arverden shook his head emphatically. "Sorry, but I don't have much of a wardrobe. I'm planning to buy clothes here on Earth as I go along." "I'll pay you 50 credits, said Crean. Silence. He added with a touch of resentment, "That's a good price." "A very good price," said Arverden. "But as I told you, I have no shirts to sell." "Well," Crean shrugged, "expect to stay on Earth quite a while, I suppose." "Maybe." "What's your line of business?" The archaeologist allowed irritation to rise to the surface. "Look, Mr. Crean, if you don't mind, I'm a little tired and would like to take a nap. Is that all right with you?" Crean frowned. "What's the matter with you? Don't your kind believe in being civil to people? I'm just asking you a polite question. No need to bite my ear off." The conversation, hitherto conducted in a low voice, had suddenly amplified itself into a near shout. Hostile expressions turned Arverden's way, and the archaeologist's lips compressed themselves into a thin line. He had asked for it, he decided bitterly. He would not have gotten into this mess if he had held aloof from the beginning. If he hadn't felt the necessity of vaunting his damned tolerance and forcing it on people who didn't want it. He said levelly, "Mr. Crean, I didn't ask you to join me, and I haven't been uncivil. I repeat, I am tired and would like to rest. I think there's nothing unusual in that." "Listen." The young man rose from his seat, threw his cigarette away with a violent gesture, and pointed a finger. "You don't have to treat me like I'm a dog or something. You stinking outsiders come here with your fine talk and standoffishness and think it gives you the right to stamp all over us. We don't have to stand for it, see? If you don't like it here, you can go back where you came from, and it won't take much more of your lip to make me light into you either. You think I'm afraid of you?" Arverden turned his head away and stared stonily out the window. Crean said no more, but took his original seat once again. There was an excited buzz of conversation round and about the plane, which Arverden ignored. He felt
rather than saw the sharpened and envenomed glances being cast at him, until gradually it passed, as all things did. He completed the journey, silent and alone. The landing at the Shikha airport was welcome. Arvardhan smiled to himself at the first sight from the air of the best damn city on earth, but found it nevertheless an immense improvement over the thick, unfriendly atmosphere of the plane. He supervised the unloading of his luggage and had it transferred into a bi-wheel cab. At least he would be the only passenger here, so that if he took care not to speak unnecessarily to the driver, he could scarcely get into trouble. "State House," he told the cabbie, and they were off. Arvardhan thus entered Shikha for the first time, and he did so on the day that Joseph Schwartz escaped from his room at the Institute for Nuclear Research. Crean watched Arvardhan leave with a bitter half-smile. He took out his little book and studied it closely between puffs at his cigarette. He hadn't gotten much out of the passengers, despite his story about his uncle, which he had used often before to good effect. To be sure, the old guy had complained about a man living past his time and had blamed it on pull with the ancients. That would come under the heading of slander against the Brotherhood. But then the geezer was heading for the 60 in a month anyway. No use putting his name down. But this outsider, that was different. He surveyed the item with a feeling of pleasure. Bell Arvardhan, Baron, Sirius Sector, curious about the 60, secretive about own affairs, entered Shikha by commercial plane, 11 a.m. Shikha time, 12 October. Anti-terrestrian attitude, very marked. This time, maybe he had a real haul. Picking up these little squealers who made incautious remarks was dull work, but things like this made it pay off. The Brotherhood would have his report before half an hour was up. He made his way leisurely off the field.